8653, it's Francis Lucas, Reel 11. Now, what happened when he got to the Rhine? I'm not quite sure when that would be, but I mean, it's going back into the normal chronology of your story. What happened when he got to the Rhine? Anything? You're well behind the line, so.
Yes, exactly.
It's not a front line tale.
No.
So, what happened next?
I suppose, really, in getting to the Rhine, it's strange the particular memories that come to you. And this particular memory is indeed the actual crossing of the Rhine. I was amazed by the length of the Bailey Bridge that had been built in this particular crossing. And I have several photographs of our crossing with the vehicles ahead.
Is it a Bailey Bridge or a pontoon bridge?
Oh, yes, it would be a pontoon bridge, wouldn't it? Indeed, you're absolutely right. Because it was hundreds of yards long. So, going over this pontoon bridge.
What was it like crossing the pontoon bridge? Because it wasn't that big, was it? Well, it was long, but it wasn't that wide.
That's right. No problem, really. You were just there in line. And in a way, it was a psychological moment. You thought, boy, this is it. We are now coming into Germany itself. And you even thought at that time, gosh, how much longer will it be before we're out of this situation? And psychologically, crossing that pontoon bridge was a landmark, and so on. And so we cross the bridge and we're deployed in the usual activities, and strangely enough, I find it difficult to be precise in specific memories, and the reason is that, as far as we were concerned, it was largely action as it was before. It was largely routine to us, and there's nothing that makes it stand out particularly in my memories.
No. Tell us a bit about the tanks that you were repairing. You often have to say, would you go forward to repair, say, the command type of tank wireless, or would your men do it?
It would depend. And as in the Alamein incident, there were times when it was so important, I felt that I ought to in any case.
Now, what tanks were they?
They were largely Shermans. there were some Churchills, but we were equipped with Shermans, and they were the standard tank.
And do you remember anything about the problems that would go wrong with the wireless kit? What set was it in the Sherman?
Yes, it was the standard number 19 set, and the majority of the problems were usually valves packing up. They were the area most likely to give trouble, and I suppose you can say 75% of the problems were simply a question of testing and replacing valves. So,
what else would it be if it wasn't the valve? I know that.
Yes. Oh, could be simple things like the disconnection of a lead to the tank aerial, where the vibration had loosened it, or one of the lads in the tank had caught themselves up in it. I suppose, technically, nothing very abstruse, fairly routine things.
Did you ever replace the whole set?
If there's any doubt at all, it always carried a couple of replacement sets, and if there's any doubt, that was the thing you tended to do, just replace the set. At that stage, we were fortunate. We were well stocked with spares, and there was no problem with equipment at that stage.
Now, so you say, for you, then that's your job, and you're doing it as you are.
Exactly.
So whether you're in Germany or
wherever, anyway, largely the same.
Now, anything you do remember about going through Germany, what reaction did you get from the German people, if you saw many of them?
All I can describe them as being, at that time, I'd describe them as being sullen. They obviously did not want to acknowledge us. They did not want to know. And although, as I'll recount later, that changed dramatically, at this stage there was a very definite standoff between us. And many would still be working in the fields and so on, and pass in the roads, and so many of their towns and villages had been brutally bombed, and you can understand perhaps a sort of quiet hostility. We're obviously not welcome.
How did you feel about them? You know, because it's a two-way process. How did you
absolutely. Absolutely. That's very, very interesting. I suppose I can only quote my own feelings, really. It was one of casual neutrality. I found myself not interested in them at that stage. They were around and about. They didn't offer smiles or what have you. And so one tended largely to ignore them and so on. Although this changed dramatically, of course, at a later stage. But at that stage, that was the general feeling and so on.
Now, what happens next then?
And so, where we got to? Well, campaign went on. As far as my unit was concerned, we tended to move north towards the area of Schleswig-Holstein. In that area, there was some quite heavy fighting that we were aware of, but steady progress was made. And I suppose the next emotional thing, which I have written about and referred to, would be the discovery of this small concentration camp.
Now, in your notes, you say you're advancing towards Hamburg in 1944, but it can't be in 44, it must have been 1945.
45, it was indeed 45.
Yeah, I'm just saying
yes.
That
so yes,
because in the notes it twice says 44, it's just a slip up.
Yes, you're absolutely right. It
now,
would have been 45.
It says towards Hamburg, or is it Hamburg or Schleswig-Holstein? My knowledge of the geography of
Well, Schleswig-Holstein area is north of Hamburg.
Right. So
and so you've got Hamburg and travelling up further.
I understand.
Yep.
About it. Right. Now, tell me the story, as much as you remember about this thing, because it was quite an emotional thing for you, I know, by discovering this small concentration camp. You don't know the name of it, do you?
No, I don't. No.
Now, tell me the whole story as you saw it at the time.
Yes. Well, we were making steady progress. We were so far behind any active advancing troops as not to be aware precisely of the fighting itself. And then we had a report from one of our associated units that they had overrun a camp, and they were horrified by what they found. And we were advised to go and visit this camp and see what it was and what was happening.
Now, why were you advised to do that? I mean,
that's very interesting. I think the powers that be, whoever made that decision, probably felt it was some indication that our liberation of Germany, and regarded as liberation, was an absolutely essential thing, and that we were there to uncover abuses that were taking place, beside it being a pure military objective. And so we were advised to go, and it was just an open invitation. that if you're in the area, go and see this camp. And what we learned subsequently, and the whole picture became clear in the later the days and weeks and months, is that in Germany, beside the notorious camps of Belsen, Auschwitz, and so on, there were a number of smaller camps that you didn't even know about. And to a great extent, these were peopled by Germans themselves, and so on, because there was indeed, it turned out, a very strong underground anti-Nazi feeling, and some, of course, had been caught in sabotaging events and so on, offences, and they were themselves being incarcerated. And this particular camp was obviously such a camp. It did have a number of other nationalities, Austrian and goodness knows what, but beside Germans themselves. And we didn't know any details about it. It just suggested that we might like to go and visit it.
What happened when you went?
And so, a sergeant friend, a colleague, and myself, we went to this camp. And we found the entrance was guarded now by half a dozen of our own lads. And we went into it. It was, first of all, even as we entered, very conscious of an offensive smell.
What kind of a smell?
I could describe it, remember it now, as a sickening smell. It had an odor about it. And as we went down into the camp entrance, there were numbers of women, guards there apparently, or had been guards, and these women looked very rough sorts. And so my colleague and myself went into the place, and there were very few, there were a few of our soldiers about, but very, very few. But the camp seemed to be in there a number of guards who appeared to be quite disreputable characters and so on. And we went to a main hut. And we entered this hut. It was quite a large place. And all I can say is that the smell now became absolutely offensive and sickening. Well, remember it. It was half dark in there and so on. And there were lines of bunks. There were four or five tiers high, with not much room, vertical room, between each of the bunks. We were conscious of a sort of a moaning in the place. And we walked down between the bunks and were horrified by what we were seeing. And what we did see, largely, was thin arms and eyes that were almost fluorescent. I remember it so well. And the bunks were occupied virtually by skeletons with the ranks over them. And it was one of the most horrifying experiences I've ever had. and we were quite overcome by it. And it seemed that our very presence in there seemed to stir the occupants of these bunks, inasmuch as they would put out their hands and try and touch you as you went by. And as I said, the one live thing seemed to be just their eyes, and it was obviously a horrifying spectacle. And I'm not exaggerating. We got out the place, and we ourselves were virtually sick. I remember that we sat outside on some wall or something, more or less to recover ourselves. And then we just entered another building that appeared to be a little more respectable, and immediately met in there quite a vivacious lady. She was, I think, Austrian or whatever. She turned out to be a doctor. She's also an inmate of the camp anyway. She could speak sufficiently good English for us to communicate. She explained to us, without our being asked, what this camp was. And it was largely those who, civilians, who shown opposition to the Nazi regime and have been themselves incarcerated and treated abominably. She explained to us that it was not an extermination camp, but we didn't know what she meant by extermination camp. And we obviously were quite naive there. And she explained that there were very big camps where routinely the occupants were taken to gas chambers and killed. We frankly thought she was exaggerating. We didn't believe her. And I'm sure we looked as if we didn't believe her. And then suddenly, she lost utter, complete control. She jumped up and down, waved her arms at us, and shouted, "I'm here now. You don't believe me. It's true, it's true, it's true. You don't believe me, but it's true." Interestingly enough, and subsequently, and by subsequently, I mean much later on, after the war ended, we learned, of course, about the camps, the extermination camps, or Buchenwald, Auschwitz, and so on. But it wasn't common knowledge at that time. And therefore, understandably, we didn't believe her. But subsequently, we realized it was all too true. And so we personally had that experience at the camp. In a way, which I was sorry about subsequently, not many of our lads did indeed take the opportunity to go and visit, as they could well have done. Very few did, I believe, but we did, etc.
And did you take any photographs? Because you had a camera, didn't you?
Not sure you had a camera, and unbelievably, I was so traumatized that in the camp itself, I didn't at that time take any photographs. Oh, just one moment. I did take a few. I have those photographs. I've forgotten that. Because there was what seemed to be, my memory serves me, a sort of outhouse. And some of our lads had got some bodies and put them in this outhouse, laid them out there. And I did take a few photographs, which I have to this day, of all these bodies in that outhouse. And so, there was that experience. But now, that wasn't the end of it.
What about the guards? Were there any of the old guards there or not? Are they all gone?
They seem to be all gone. The majority of the people there, the staff there, guards, call them what you like, were women. And I should explain that one thing we found offensive to a degree is that they endeavour to make advances to us and indicated the fact that for a few cigarettes they will operate according to our pleasure. We found that offensive to a degree. And I, again, some of these things you will remember. They stick on your mind and it's there. Subsequently, what happened? It wasn't long after that, before we entered Hamburg.
Now, what happened there?
When we had settled down in Hamburg, no more than a week later, Arthur thought, our senior officer, whoever it was himself obviously very concerned and upset by what he'd seen, and the fact that the population in Hamburg, by and large, we gathered, seemed to be wholly unaware of what was being done almost on their doorstep. And so he decided that something had been done about it. And so what happened, we took over an empty showroom, it was probably a motor car showroom originally, somewhere in the midst of Hamburg. We brought in a number of the bodies from this camp. We laid them out and displayed them in the showroom. We sent out a number of trucks with three or four of our men on. And this sounds unbelievable, but they would stop in one of the main streets. They would herd around 10 or 15 or perhaps more of the people on the street, insist they got up into the trucks. They obviously couldn't make out what was happening. And they were driven to this showroom, and they were forced or insisted to go in. One of our officers, who was a fluent German speaker, the bodies were laid out there on the floor, and he gave a description, an account of where they came from, what had happened, and so on. And it was obvious that this was completely unexpected and new and offensive to these German civilians who'd been coerced in the coming. And I remember looking at them, I was there for a period. Some were distressed, some were completely indifferent, not wanting to look, showing no sign of concern one way or the other, and obviously did not want to know and felt they'd been coerced into something which they shouldn't have been. And so what that achieved, one doesn't know, very little, I think. Then finally...
What were you doing in Hamburg, other than that? I mean, were you just... Where were you staying? What were you doing?
Just to finish this...
Sorry.
Yeah. Finally, it was decided that a proper burial should be given to the bodies. Local undertakers were required to provide their coffins, and a proper formal burial following a procession through a section of Hamburg to the cemetery took place. I have got photographs of this, of the procession. Quite a number of people in the streets came out to see it, and the bodies were appropriately buried in a local cemetery and must be there to this day, and so on. So what was achieved by it, I don't know, but that was the conclusion of that matter. So it was largely emotional. And from time to time, I don't know whether I was particularly sensitive, from time to time, one seemed to get tied up in this emotional side of things.
Now, so what did happen next? What were you doing in Hamburg, besides this, obviously?
Yeah.
Which is obviously part a big part of what you were doing there.
It's only in Hamburg about a week or 10 days, and then we were advised, during that period, by the way, hostilities have ceased.
Now, what do you remember of that, VE Day? Any celebrations?
Strangely enough, no. It was at such low key that there's no, where we were concerned, rightly or wrongly, there's no official announcement. And we just sort of gathered, it's all stopped, things have ended. We weren't given any celebratory or other announcements, but the news just got around, oh boy, it's all over. And there you were. So you shrug your shoulders, and the lads will say, oh well, we'll soon be back home in Blighty. And it was remarkably low key, strangely enough.
So, what happened next?
Well, we were told that we would be a sort of occupying force, and that we'd be settled in Schleswig-Holstein, north of Hamburg, in the area of a town called Itzehoe and Kensenhusen.
Do you know how you spell them?
Itzehoe. Ah, dear me. I would have to look at the map.
Okay, Itzehoe and Kellerhusen.
And Kellerhusen. My own unit. We were taking the Kellerhusen, which was a very attractive village. I suppose about 2,000 inhabitants. Property was commandeered. Where my unit was concerned, a series of adjoining flats were commandeered, and the occupiers or owners were requested to vacate them, but to leave all their fittings and furniture and so on intact there. Excuse me. And so we were installed in these flats, and very comfortably installed, I must say. And so there was just a quiet, almost domestic period. Very little then happened from day to day. We did have the odd parades now and again, but it was quite a quiet period.
No duties?
Very few routine duties. But the significant thing was, very soon, the attitude of the local populace in that area changed utterly completely